It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We check in on manufacturing in Wisconsin. Data from the Labor Department, it indicates our state employs right around 475,000 people in manufacturing. It's a workforce showing recovery to pre-pandemic levels. Call in with questions about this sector, your experiences, they're welcome as well, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jared Steigenberger is president of Bassett Mechanical, based in Kakana. Jared, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. And Ben Bertram is owner of Fiberglass Solutions in Green Bay. Ben, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Ben, let's start with you. There is sentiment out there for manufacturers that it's still a rough road. It's still difficult to find workers. What is your situation with labor?
Yeah, that's a great question. Right now, personally, in our business, we're doing pretty well, but it is difficult to find workers. And from what we're seeing, you know, there's the shortage of employees in the state and in the nation really isn't going to change anytime soon. I've done a lot of research, gone to a lot of seminars recently, just kind of talking about the economy and everything we're seeing. And the reality is we aren't making more workers every day. So we're kind of, what we're seeing now is going to be the future for the next anywhere from 5, 10, 15 years. So it's definitely a changing landscape.
Ben, can you briefly explain the skill sets your workers bring to the job and help us visualize what you manufacture, how you fit into the fiberglass marketplace?
Certainly. So we manufacture commercial and industrial fiberglass. It's called fiberglass reinforced plastic, FRP. So if I use that term, that's what most people refer to as fiberglass. So our employees are skilled in the fabrication of fiberglass, working with the resins and the fiberglass to make the FRP products. We do a lot in the state of Wisconsin and the United States in the dairy industry. We manufacture walls and ceiling systems for the dairy plants. We manufacture brine systems for making cheese. We do a lot in the wastewater and water industry, servicing fiberglass tanks. And we also do a lot in the paper industry with fiberglass piping, tanks, and anything else, FRP, that needs to be serviced.
I was thinking of you yesterday as we had some insulation installed, and I was wondering, I wonder if this is Ben's fiberglass product.
No, and we don't deal with that on the fiberglass side. We do own another business that does fiberglass insulation on pipe and duct, but on the fiberglass manufacturing side, we do not make the insulation. We're more commercial industrial parts, service and repair, and then we do a lot of custom build stuff as well.
Well, Jared, over to you. Bassett Mechanical, it's at a different scale with about 550 workers. Can you talk about your HR situation?
Yeah, I echo Ben's comments. The labor challenges and shortages are probably here to stay. I mean, it's a combination of maybe, you know, less people going into the manufacturing trades, and the demand for our services is increasing. So it's kind of the double storm, so to speak. We've done a pretty good job. Our trade labor comes from two different unions, and we've done a pretty good job of filling our open positions, but definitely that has always been a challenge. And, you know, filling some of our technical positions that support our manufacturing operations, whether it's engineers or technicians, has always been a challenge as well. But we're out there aggressively recruiting talents. We're stressing our people-centric culture when we're talking to prospective candidates. And we've really invested in training and developments as kind of, you know, to really try to draw people to Bassett Mechanical.
And can you take us inside your operations as well, inside your plant and the services that you're providing in these contracts?
Yeah, our manufacturing operations, we focus on, we're doing heavy, I would say heavy fabrications, welding, assembly. We're making vessels, pipe fabrications, sheet metal ducting, large industrial ducting systems, skid packages, which are, you know, fairly complex. So our labor is skilled labor. The good thing again is our partnerships with our unions, they go through an apprenticeship program. And so they're working while they're getting really good training. So we have really talented, skilled labor. It's just a matter of trying to find folks to fill those open seats.
How long have you had that relationship with the unions?
It's been for many, many years, decades. Mm. And we have a really good collaborative relationship with our unions, which is very helpful in these tight labor markets.
Will you make machinery? I'm curious. Will you make machinery to make semiconductors? I'm not sure if you got that memo that there's that global chip shortage, you know?
Well, we experienced the chip shortage quite heavily here in the last year.
Oh, really? Okay.
In our construction business, in our manufacturing plant feeds our large construction jobs with prefabrications. And then we're also selling fabrications to outside external customers. But we do a lot of controls work. And in that controls work, to control the systems that we're installing at customer sites, we're relying heavily on chips and electronic components. And we felt that pain a year ago. That's come back a little bit for us, where it's more, I would say, more normal. But that definitely was part of our business that we had to work through.
Well, let me reintroduce you both here for a moment as we talk about the state of our Wisconsin manufacturing industry. And we have a couple company leaders giving us more of a ground level view. Jared Steigenberger is president of Bassett Mechanical. We've been just chatting with him. Ben Bertram is here as well, owner of a fiberglass company in Green Bay. You can join in the conversation about manufacturing, questions you have. Maybe you want to talk about apprenticeships. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm just curious from both of you, as before we move on from staffing, I'm wondering, Ben, could you handle more contracts if you had a larger staff, or are you trying, you know, to bring in more work, or do you feel like you're at the right place?
That's a great question. We are actually, I feel we could handle more work if we had, you know, additional employees. But what I would say is we aren't necessarily turning down work. But I mean, what we really try to do at Fiberglass Solutions is make sure that we balance our employees' lifestyle. It's really important for us to make sure that they've got a good lifestyle outside of work, not just at work. And so in doing so, we manage to try and maintain a 40-hour work week for our employees. And there's always overtime, and there's always people who want overtime. But we do our best to make sure that we're giving them a good balanced lifestyle. So at this point, we haven't been turning away work. Unfortunately, what happens is our lead times get longer if we can't produce quite as quickly. But it's one of those things. If you're not growing, you're dying. So you're always trying to grow. You want to make sure that you're bringing in new work so that you can keep the jobs for the people, keep good jobs for the people. So it's a challenge for sure. We definitely fight with that on a daily basis. Do we go after more work heavily? Do we just kind of stay where we're at and grow slowly? It's something we as business owners battle with. And definitely, if we had more employees out there, I think we'd definitely be going more aggressively at new business. But for now, we're kind of filtering it and scaling it gradually so that we can make sure that new employees get trained properly in how to manufacture fiberglass and make sure that we don't overwhelm our current workforce.
Jared, any thoughts there on managing growth and contracts and you know, growing at what you feel is a reasonable pace?
Yeah, I almost could just say ditto to what Ben said. At Bassett, we really focus on intentional growth, and it really is finding that balance between, you know, the opportunities we pursue. Do we have the resources to meet the expectations of our customers? And then, as Ben said, we really are cognizant of how much stress we're putting on our employees. The last couple of years, we've really grown our business. We've hit record levels. We've been very fortunate to be able to recruit and bring people into our offices. But as Ben said, we're in the exact same spot as his company. Every day, we're looking at, should we pursue this or should we not pursue this opportunity based on our resources? And so we're definitely not turning work away. We're also out there aggressively pursuing work, but it's a real fine line and a balance, because you have to really be conscious of, you know, at the end of the day, you're trying to meet that customer's expectation. And that comes to having the right resources in place to do that. So it's a real balance for us as well.
Jared Steigenberger and Ben Bertram, they lead Wisconsin companies in industrial machinery manufacturing and fiberglass sectors. As we get a ground level look at industry in our state, what they're grappling with, call in with questions about aspects of manufacturing that you're curious about, issues on your mind like skill sets and automation, industrial capacity, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here as we get this economic outlook on manufacturing in Wisconsin. Two company leaders who have insights into their sector. Call in with your questions about manufacturing. Maybe it's related to skills training or technology, industrial capability, supply chain issues at your facility. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jared Steigenberger is president of a Kaukauna-based industrial machinery manufacturing firm, Custom Fabricator. And Ben Bertram owns a fiberglass company in Green Bay. I want to turn now to the education pipeline and workforce and how that's going. Because last year, we talked about this Harvard Business School study that found the relationship between our community colleges and our employers is strained. And we talked with Morna Foy, who's president of Wisconsin's technical college system, and she talked about that assessment from Harvard and says the relationship strain started decades ago. Let's listen.
Business and educators and leaders of community college settled into a comfortable low-level equilibrium. And everyone believes that that low-level equilibrium is fine. Well, the reality is, over the last two decades, automation has come in like a huge force and completely changed the nature of many middle skills positions.
Actually, that was not Morna Foy, but I want to get your reaction, Ben Bertram. What do you feel is the relationship like in education and community colleges, especially with your workers?
Another great question. And something I think we're very fortunate to have up in the Green Bay area is NWTC, Northeast Wisconsin Tech. And I think they're doing a great job in working to get with local manufacturers and determine, you know, what are the training programs that they need in order to train employees properly to go out into the workforce. And with Green Bay area being so heavy in manufacturing, I think it's really critical that we look at this as a great opportunity to partner with them and work on developing skill sets for our labor. Now, fiberglass in general, I don't believe we have much of a program at the trade school level. There are some larger fiberglass manufacturers in the area. However, it's one of those that maybe not necessarily it warrants having programs there yet to help out. I know some other companies have looked into it. But specifically when she was talking about the metal side of things, and I'm sure Jared can speak better to that, but there's a ton of opportunity for students and kids to get into the trade schools and learn a trade. And I think they're doing a better job now partnering. And I think we even need to get back deeper before I went to a presentation the other day and in talking about when do we start to get kids introduced to this idea of trade schools as being okay. I think for years and years, our parents drilled into us that we needed to go to college and college was the answer. And right now, to be perfectly honest, there are some fantastic paying jobs where you can make excellent careers in manufacturing, excellent careers. And people haven't quite shifted that mindset at home yet. And I think we really need to focus not so much as getting to the kids and children once they're in high school to tell them about trade schools. I think we need to do it at a parent level. We need to get down to the parents and say, hey, these are opportunities for our kids that are great opportunities for your child to be successful and earn a great living and make a great career out of it and really get ahead of it earlier in the game so that they realize that trade schools are a great option once they get to high school. Unfortunately, I feel like once they're in high school, they almost have an idea where they're going. Most kids do. Hmm. So it's kind of an interesting take. I think we need to get a little further back so that we realize that these trade schools we do have in Wisconsin, which I feel we have a great trade school program, are a very viable option for a successful future.
Jared, what is it like at Bassett as you work with community colleges? Do you feel, and tech schools, do you feel like you have that relationship established?
Yeah, we're fortunate. We have a really strong relationship with NWTC up in Green Bay, and then here in the Fox Valley Technical College. In fact, we sit on some of their committees to help influence, for instance, in our HVAC service technician and their programs. So a lot of our technicians will do that two-year technical degree, and then they'll come to Bass Mechanical and enter the five-year apprenticeship. So we have good relationships with our technical colleges. Once again, our unions, very strong relationship with our unions. One thing that's really interesting is, you know, the message before talked about automation. Well, in our industry, there's a lot of technology and change that we're adapting. And we're going from 2D designs to 3D virtual designs. Well, that changes the skill sets of our trade labor employees. And in partnership with our unions, they're changing their classes and their curriculum to kind of meet the change in technology and automation. My last comment kind of dovetails with what Ben said, is we have a strong youth apprenticeship program where we're partnered with the union. The state provides guidance and assistance on that, and we're getting into the high schools and hiring high school students, boys and girls that are coming to work for Bass Mechanical and learning about the trades, and then gives them, you know, kind of a rotational experience at Bass. So when they're thinking about where they want to go after high school, they're getting exposure to the trades and the goodness. And as Ben said, these are very well-paying jobs with great benefits, and you can have a wonderful career in the trades.
It sounds like you have to be very aggressive and start very early in your recruiting efforts.
Yes, and you need partnerships, as you alluded to, partnerships with the technical colleges, partnerships with our unions, and then truthfully, our people are our best ambassadors. They're all promoting what they do for a living in the community.
Talking about the state of Wisconsin's manufacturing industry with a pair of company leaders, Ben Bertram owns a Fiberglass Solutions in Green Bay. Jared Steigenberger is president of Bassett Mechanical. You can join in, 800-642-1234. We heard from Kathy in Dodgeville, emailed asking, why doesn't anyone talk about the possibility of hiring immigrant labor to fill manufacturing jobs that are vacant? Kathy says many people want to come into this country for the opportunities that it offers and are being denied that opportunity. What about immigrant labor in this, in this sector, Ben?
Well, I think immigrant labor has been a part of the United States history from the very start. I mean, you've always had immigration as a major force in the workforce, whether it be from when the country started until now. I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on immigration laws and standards and everything else, but obviously we have a way to get legal immigration. And I think absolutely, if you look at our workforce in America, as we stated before, it's not growing. We're kind of going to sit at this level for the next 10, 15 years. It's kind of the way it is. So yes, we do have to look at other options for where does the workforce come from? And legal immigration, I think, is a great way to do it. There's plenty of opportunities. And again, these opportunities aren't going away anytime soon. I think you run into a lot of political issues. And again, I'm no expert in immigration reform and immigration policies. But legal immigration absolutely would be a great asset to manufacturing.
Jared, and just a quick follow-up here, because when you did mention automation, I wanted to ask you, there is that fear that robots are replacing open manufacturing positions in Wisconsin. Is there any truth to that?
Well, I'm not sure if they're replacing them. I think something I read an article recently that there's a major manufacturing skills gap, I think over $2 million unfilled jobs. So I'm not sure if they're replacing. I wouldn't look at it as people are going to lose jobs. It would just help to fill the void of jobs that go unfilled. We see our automation actually is helping us grow our business. And so we don't look at it as a replacement, but it's a growth vehicle to expand our ability to grow the business and then maybe fill some gaps for positions that otherwise would go unfilled. So I don't look at it as a direct competition to replacing a human being. It supplements growth and addresses that skills gap that's out there. And as we talked about early on, we're going to be in this labor shortage for quite some time.
We are almost out of time here, but I want to ask you, and Ben, just as you look at inflation and the impact of inflation, are you concerned about an economic slowdown?
I think we always have to be prepared for an economic slowdown. I don't think we've necessarily seen it yet. Americans still have a lot of disposable income that they can spend, and markets are still up because of it, and people don't seem to be shying away from spending it just yet. I think there definitely will be a slowdown. I think it's something as business owners we all prepare for, and we have to plan for it. But we will see some sort of a slowdown, but for now it still really appears to be going strong, especially in Northeast Wisconsin.
Jared, any final thoughts here in the last few seconds on inflation?
Yes, same for us. We're seeing a really strong 2023. There's a little cautiousness by our customers as they're grappling with higher costs and a little bit of slowdown their demand. But overall, we feel it's still pretty robust economic activity here in Wisconsin.
Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Kay. It was great to be on.
Ben Bertram is owner of Fiberglass Solutions in Green Bay. Jared Steigenberger, president of Bassett Mechanical in Kakana. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Police in Wisconsin and across the country have faced increasing questions about their response to people experiencing a mental or behavioral health crisis, especially in schools. As Hope Kerwin reports, a growing number of departments are turning to therapy dogs as a new tool to aid their response.
The newest rookie at the La Crosse Police Department is already patrolling the hallways of Northside Elementary School. He and his partner, Officer Ryan Ledvina, cause an immediate reaction among the students. Cheddar is a five-month-old Labradoodle puppy who's in training to be the department's new therapy dog. He has fluffy orange-brown fur and lots of puppy energy. And during a visit to a kindergarten classroom, he is the center of attention.
Are you an officer?
I am.
Oh my God.
He's my partner.
This positive interaction is exactly what Cheddar is here to do. Unlike patrol canines, police therapy dogs aren't responsible for sniffing out drugs or taking down a fleeing suspect. Cheddar's job will be to help soothe someone who's experiencing a mental health crisis or to comfort the victim of a crime. Sean Coudron is La Crosse's chief of police.
We wanted Cheddar to be able to assist in those situations, maybe help bring a calming nature to the situation so that, you know, we as police officers could better help them.
La Crosse is one of at least eight departments in Wisconsin that added therapy dogs within the last year, and there's science to back up the impact these dogs can have. A study published last year by researchers in England found that elementary students who interacted with a therapy dog had lower stress levels than students who didn't. Oshkosh Police Chief Dean Smith is president of the Wisconsin Chiefs of Police Association. He says many departments are looking for new ways to respond to people who are having a mental or behavioral health emergency.
We have to find different ways to solve problems within our communities, and using different tools available to us, I just feel like it's a tool that's going to be more and more prevalent within agencies.
For many departments, the dogs are funded primarily through donations. Coudron says Cheddar was donated by a nearby breeder, and a local dog trainer donated obedience and therapy classes. But he thinks any added costs are a worthwhile investment. He's hoping Cheddar will serve as an ambassador for officers, especially with residents who don't feel comfortable approaching the police.
It's just another resource for us to share with our community and to break down barriers when it comes to just interacting with anyone, to understand who we are as a department. Cheddar kind of helps humanize us as officers.
Coudron acknowledged that there's been increased scrutiny of police in recent years. In La Crosse, the school district decided to scale back the number of officers in schools after finding a higher rate of juvenile arrests in the community than in similar cities. Coudron says getting Cheddar was not a direct response to the criticism, but he believes the program highlights the value officers can bring to schools and the community. In Wausau, school resource officer Nick Stetzer has been working with his dog Badge for almost 6 years now. Before he was a police therapy dog, Badge was Stetzer's pet. Stetzer says he put Badge through therapy training after he saw a growing number of kids taken into custody for their protection after making suicidal comments. Stetzer says it was a tough sell to his superiors in the department, but he was convinced a therapy dog could comfort students during a traumatic experience.
I don't know what it is, but talking to me with a dog is way easier than talking to me as a police officer without having the dog. Just as soon as he walks in the room, you can tell people act differently.
Stetzer says he's found that kids who are struggling can benefit from spending time with Badge before they reach a crisis point. A game of fetch with a flat-coated retriever might create an opportunity for him to bring up tough questions and find out what resources a student needs. At almost 9 years old, Stetzer says Badge is getting close to the typical retirement age for police canines.
Hopefully we can make it to 10. He's slowing down a little bit, still doing really good work.
But even when Badge hangs up his leash, Stetzer says he's confident there will be support for the therapy dog program for years to come. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The U.S. Sentencing Commission, a bipartisan independent agency, it's considering changing how federal prisoners can request compassionate release. Call in with your questions and comments about inmates with extraordinary circumstances. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Erica Zunkel is a clinical professor of law and associate director of the Federal Criminal Justice Clinic at University of Chicago Law School. She testified before the U.S. Sentencing Commission on proposed changes to compassionate release guidelines. Erica, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks so much for having me.
So compassionate release, essentially early release for incarcerated people in federal prisons when circumstances make it unjustifiable. Can you walk us through what is a typical scenario that leads to compassionate release?
That's a really good question, Kate, and it is changing. What the Sentencing Commission is considering is adding more categories for compassionate release. So I think it's helpful to go back to 1984, which is actually when Congress made some changes to the federal criminal system, both by creating the Sentencing Commission and getting rid of indeterminate sentencing. So that gave judges a lot of discretion over sentences. And what Congress did was say, we're going to have a sentencing commission, they're going to create guidelines that are going to govern judges and how they determine sentences. The Congress also at that same time abolished federal parole, which had been on the books for a long period of time. And that was a way that people were able to go before a parole board and say, you know, I've rehabilitated, I should get my, I should get out early, essentially. Before the end of my sentence. And Congress said, we don't want that anymore. At the same time that they abolished federal parole, they also passed what has been become known as compassionate release. It's a sentencing modification mechanism when there are extraordinary and compelling circumstances. So all these things came together at the same time, and Congress said to the Sentencing Commission, this newly formed agency, you are the ones that decide what are extraordinary and compelling reasons. And Congress also put the Bureau of Prisons in charge of actually bringing these motions. The Bureau of Prisons is the federal jailing bureaucracy in our country. So it was the Sentencing Commission to decide what could be extraordinary and compelling, and then it was up to the Bureau of Prisons to bring these motions. The problem was, since 1984, with the Bureau of Prisons having this authority, they really never brought motions for compassionate release. It was exceedingly rare.
That's what I'm curious about. Does the Bureau of Prisons act on that, grant compassionate release ever, or is this process directly winding through the courts?
So they were not bringing the motions, and Congress became fed up with that. And that was the result of many years of advocacy. Of course, it's a big deal if Congress, given the dysfunction of Congress, if they're saying something is wrong. And they said federal judges should be essentially in charge of compassionate release in the federal system, and people should be able to bypass the Bureau of Prisons, which was not doing its job, and should be able to take their extraordinary and compelling situations to judges directly. So that was the change that was made in 2018 with the First Step Act. At that time, the Sentencing Commission lost a quorum. So they need a quorum to act and make decisions. They didn't have one. So what it left was this uncertain legal landscape. Judges were for the first time getting these motions, but they didn't have the guidance from the Sentencing Commission about what could be an extraordinary and compelling reason after Congress made these changes. So what we've seen over the past 4 years is judges making different decisions about what can be extraordinary and compelling. And that's varied based on the geography where people are bringing their motions in the Seventh Circuit, which encompasses Wisconsin, Indiana, and Illinois, where I am. Compassionate release has been quite restricted. In other places around the country, judges have more discretion to decide extraordinary and compelling reasons. The timing of expanding compassionate release by Congress was really fortuitous, of course, because in this period we've had the COVID pandemic, and that has allowed judges to release people who were at risk of very serious illness or death being in these, you know, COVID breeding grounds and in prison where it was spreading like wildfire. So that was a good thing that the commission is now wanting to codify and put into law through these new compassionate release guidelines.
I want to get into these guideline proposal expansions in just a moment here, but, you know, does the incarcerated person need to hire a lawyer to go through the compassionate release process? Do they need representation for an optimal outcome?
In my view, definitely. Our clinic, we do federal compassionate release work here at the University of Chicago Law School. We have been involved in representing a lot of different people in the past 4 years, some who have medical related reasons for seeking compassionate release, some who have what I call non-medical extraordinary and compelling reasons. And having looked at a lot of motions and a lot of compassionate release grants, I think the quality of representation is incredibly important to the outcome. So in my clinic, we have the ability to hire experts to review people's Bureau of Prisons records, to evaluate and determine if there are, you know, medical, what the scope of their medical issues or mental health issues might be. And then, of course, raise the legal arguments in the most compelling, in the most compelling way. So I think attorneys are absolutely essential. Federal defenders and court-appointed attorneys in the federal system have been handling heroically a lot of these motions, and defenders and court-appointed attorneys will be essential for making sure that the broadening of compassionate release is something that can be realized for people who are currently in federal prison behind bars.
So, you know, you've brought up the Bureau of Prisons in this, and the judges in the courts, circuit courts, and the attorneys representing the inmates. What involvement, I'm curious, or sway does the prison warden have in this process? Mm-hmm.
That's a really good question, Kate. So what the First Step Act requires is the Bureau of Prisons hasn't been completely sidelined from this process. The statute requires people to make an initial request for compassionate release to the warden of the facility in which they are imprisoned. That is what we term an exhaustion requirement. So we have to make that request before we can go into court and ask the federal judge to grant the motion. So what this has become more or less is a pro forma request to the warden explaining the extraordinary and compelling reasons for release, describing some release planning, where the person will live, et cetera. And then the warden has it in his or her hands to make an initial determination on that request. And then if they approve it, it would go into various levels of the BOP bureaucracy. The Department of Justice would also be involved. The process is just Byzantine, really, if you even get past that initial approval. And one thing that Congress was concerned about was the length of time that this process was taking within the Bureau of Prisons and trying to expedite that process. So the expectation really is that the warden will deny it. We've received many pro forma denials, and then you can go into court. Again, because the Bureau of Prisons is agreeing to compassionate release in such a small sliver of cases.
University of Chicago clinical law professor Erica Zunkel helping us understand the debate over when people in federal prison should be able to ask for early release. Colin, now with your questions, your comments about compassionate release, how you think the system should handle terminal illness or advanced age, other circumstances, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore what the future holds for the federal compassionate release law that allows people in federal prison to be freed early for extraordinary and compelling reasons like terminal illness or old age. Call in with questions or changes you would like to make to the law, what you want the Sentencing Commission to know, 800-642-1234. Erica Zunkel is here, a clinical professor of law at University of Chicago. Erica, I just mentioned terminal illness and old age. What is on the table in terms of expanding the guidelines that the commission is considering?
So there have always been reasons beyond medical reasons in the compassionate release policy statement and guidelines for the Bureau of Prisons and judges. So one that has been on the books for a long time is extraordinary family circumstances. And that has been when a minor child of a person in prison loses a caregiver and has no one else to take care of them. So that is a category, along with the medical categories, that the commission has proposed expanding. So for family circumstances, if there was a spouse or a partner who needed caregiving and couldn't get it from anyone else, the commission's amendments would expand to include that as an extraordinary and compelling reason. The commission has also broadened some of the medical, serious medical reasons for compassionate release. I think the most interesting addition that the commission has made is adding a changes in the law provision. So what we've seen in the last 4 years is that people have come to federal judges and have said, Congress has changed the laws relating to the punishment and sentence I would receive today. And that is an extraordinary and compelling reason in my individualized case. It essentially makes my sentence today unfair and inequitable. And the courts across the country have viewed that particular issue in different ways, and they've come out different ways.
So this is something. Yeah. This is the non-retroactive sentencing piece of it?
Yes. Yeah, so Congress made a number of changes, for example, to drug statutes and mandatory minimum sentences and some firearms enhancements that had the effect of drastically changing what the sentencing structure is today, but Congress did not make those changes retroactive. So what that has meant is that people who were subject to these 924C firearm stacking provisions were subject to, there's one case where it was a 218-year sentence, which today would be drastically lower by hundreds of years. And so the question for judges is that an extraordinary and compelling reason, this change in the law that was not made retroactive when you look at it in an individualized, how it applies in an individual case. And the commission has weighed in and said, sentencing changes or changes in the law that render a sentence inequitable are an extraordinary and compelling reason. So it will be interesting to see what they do with the final amendments on that particular issue.
We're talking about compassionate release from prison with Erica Zunkel, who's Associate Director of the Federal Criminal Justice Clinic at the University of Chicago Law School. Join in at 800-642-1234. Your questions about compassionate release and comments. Erica, say these guidelines are expanded or there are changes, would that affect compassionate release in state prisons? Would there be a ripple effect?
That's a good question, Kate. This applies and would apply to the roughly 160,000 people who are in federal prisons across the country. It would not apply to state prisoners. Across the country, different states have different types of compassionate release programs. Some are only for terminal illness and medical reasons. Some states have other post-conviction sentencing reduction procedures. Right now, they're around the country called second look mechanisms, which is becoming more common, where at a certain period in someone's sentence, after they've served a certain amount of time, they can go to the judge for a second look and see if a reduction is appropriate. So the states, you know, do things very differently, and this would only apply in federal court. But if there, you know, if it ends up being a good thing, which I very much think expanded compassionate release would be, it may have ripple effects in other places.
What is a possible timeline here for potential changes? Give us a bit of a roadmap.
So the commission is accepting public comment on all of its proposed amendments. So there are proposals for other guidelines as well. They've held hearings the past couple of days. They held a hearing on the compassionate release policy statement in February. They are now going to consider what kinds of changes they may make. And then we expect that they will publish their final amendments in early May. Those then are considered by Congress, and if Congress does not do anything with those, they would go into effect in November.
We only have a few seconds left. How important are second chances?
They are so important, Kate. We've seen in the federal system it can be harsh and draconian, and we need a mechanism that can recognize that laws change, people change, and circumstances change. And this is a really important step in the right direction for recognizing more second chances in the federal system.
Erica, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate.
Erica Zunkel is a law professor and associate director of the Federal Criminal Justice Clinic at University of Chicago Law School. She gave testimony to the U.S. Sentencing Commission on proposed changes to compassionate release. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.